You can get 3 months of The Spectator for just £15 and a free bottle of Pro Roger champagne if you go to spectator.co.uk/jingle. This offer is UK only and subject to availability.
Hello and welcome to Women with Balls, where I, Katie Balls, speak to today's trailblazers. My guest today is one of the country's most decorated athletes. Her dominance in both cycling and swimming is exhaustive, and her list of achievements, quite simply, exhausting or impressive. A 45-time world champion, a 23-time European champion, a 77-time world record breaker, including times where she broke her own record. She is also a 6-times British national track champion, was the first disabled cyclist to compete for Britain at the Commonwealth Games, and she was given a damehood after the 2012 London Games for services to paracycling. Having won 30 Paralympic medals, including 19 gold, she is Britain's most successful Paralympian of all time. My guest today is Sarah Story. Sarah, thank you for joining the podcast today. To be honest, we have lots of impressed people on this podcast, but just reading out the introduction, I'm just very impressed.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Where do you put all your medals?
They're in socks. So we generally, most athletes will, you know, say, can I see your medal? And they'll pull it out of a sock. The most convenient thing you have in the village that you can wrap your medal in to keep it safe. And then you never take it out of the sock because you never take anything thinking, oh, I'm going to win a medal. So that's the only thing you absolutely have.
You must have quite a big sock drawer these days then.
Well, there's a lot of odd socks, I think, in the sock drawer. But it's important to win an even number of medals and you can take a pair.
Now, on this podcast, we like to start with your childhood and then, of course, we'll get to the career. But, I mean, how would you describe your childhood to our listeners?
A very active childhood. I'm one of three, so I'm the eldest. My sister's 20 months younger and my brother's 5 years younger. So very active and outdoorsy childhood. My parents were both arcalers. My dad was also the superintendent of our church youth club. And we just did lots of different sporting activities. And I was just enthralled by every sporting opportunity my primary school threw at me and got involved with them all.
And swimming was one of those?
Swimming was, yeah. And our primary school at that point had its own swimming club. So I learned to swim when I was 4 and I competed from being about 6 years old. I was the fastest swimmer in my school in year 4. So that didn't please the year 5s and 6s. But I always loved watching sports. And the first games I watched, I was 6 years old in 1984. And from that point on, I just wanted to be an athlete. And I always say, although I was a swimmer first and I loved swimming, it didn't really matter to me whether it was swimming or a different sport.
And I think you've spoken publicly before about having a bit of a difficult time at school, I think, too, at a young age.
Yeah, so when I came home from my first games, I was 14. I'd just gone into year 10. And up until that point, you know, I just was one of the kids at school who was very sporty and was going to the games. And when I came home, I had 2 gold medals, 3 silvers, a bronze. It's my first 2 world records. And I was bullied for being an athlete and being arriving at school with wet hair, just being different, never being available for sleepovers or trips to the cinema. And I just became this gradual walking conversation stopper. Rumours spread about why I'd arrive at school with wet hair and why I was too good for people to go to the cinema on a Friday. And
I still arrived to work with wet hair. So,
well, I think, yeah. And kids can, I think it was the lack of understanding about what I was doing. And my school had told me not to kind of said, bring the medals in once and then don't bring them back and don't talk about what you do. So it was kind of a blessing and a curse because if I'd have been a big show off, that would have also been wrong. But I was very much a sort of quieter, keep myself to myself, not mention what I was doing at the weekends. And that obviously was not a great thing either.
And throughout this, were your parents very supportive of, you know, parent drop-offs, getting you to the right places? It's quite an effort from them too, right?
Huge effort. And parents make the world go around, especially when you know, you can't drive yourself anywhere or you're too young to get on the bus. So for me, my mum and dad were just very, very kind of practical. You know, your school life isn't going to last much longer. Your sporting career could last many more years. They didn't know at that point it would be 30, 32 more years. But just, you know, be as brave as you can and try not to allow it to affect you. And of course, I had so many friends in sport that it didn't actually matter to me. You know, I was just had a quieter time during the week at school and then I'd go out and have my fun with all the girls and guys that were on the sporting teams.
And then thinking ahead to your career, we often say, what did you want to be when you're younger? Were you pretty sure it was going to involve sport of some sort? Or
When I went to my first games, I realised that I absolutely loved what I was doing. I wanted to do that for as long as I possibly could. But I was also very aware that I needed to have more than just one string to my bow. I was a very good student, did GCSEs and A-levels, went to university, and I decided that I was really interested in physical activity and health as well as the sports side of science. So that's what I did. I did sport and exercise science. I always thought that maybe it would lead to, a career in health in some way. And I guess in a roundabout kind of way, it does now. But for me, initially, it was a case of making sure that I could fully understand everything behind what I was doing as an athlete, and also having that academic side that would give me something if sport stopped suddenly.
And did it mean that you approached things in terms of like going about training or what you're eating in a different way from having studied that side of it?
Well, yeah, I tried to. And I think it was a mixture of having life experience of going through things. So when I was being bullied at school, I developed an eating disorder as kind of my way of trying to control things. And I knew what good diet looked like, but it was more of a cry for help and my way of managing things. And then also when I got to university, I was trying to sort of coach myself, but my naivety of my age meant that I wasn't a very good judge of workload. And although you learn about the science of sport and the physiology and anatomy and physiology of the body, managing workload is an incredibly personal thing to every athlete. So you'll have some athletes who are incredibly, capable of hours and hours and hours, and then others that have to have a much more light touch approach in comparison. So I had to find that out through trial and error. And unfortunately, I ended up with chronic fatigue syndrome, which was just down to the fact that I was trying my hardest to apply the science I knew about, but wasn't doing it very successfully on myself.
Well, I was about to mention that. I mean, what was it like being diagnosed with that? Was it something where it took a while to get to the point of knowing why you were feeling the way you were?
No, absolutely. It was really, I just thought I was unfit. I felt terrible. I was performing terribly. I just assumed that I wasn't doing enough work. And I guess that's where the naivety was. I was actually doing too much and my body was wrecked. I was diagnosed as having had glandular fever, and that virus had effectively not left my body and had caused my, potentially could have been something like pericarditis. But what they told me was that if I didn't stop training and overtraining, I would end up with myocarditis, which was almost irreversible. And they said, you've got chronic fatigue syndrome. You need to spend 6 weeks doing nothing, which is quite hard in your final year at uni. And then we need to build you up really slowly. And it started with 5 minutes a day in the pool. I was like, well, it's just not worth getting wet for. I've got to get in the water, do 5 minutes and get out. And they were like, this is the process. So once they explained that process, and I guess that talks to me and my personality, it's like, very process driven. It gave me stepping stones to work towards, and I followed it, religiously. But it did take about 4 years to fully get back to the training animal person that I was before and I am again today.
When did you decide to make that switch to cycling?
So I decided at the end of 2005, or towards the end of 2005, with help from my swimming coach. He was the person who'd helped me overcome chronic fatigue syndrome. He'd brought me back to my third and fourth Paralympics as a swimmer. And I'd been training on a bike because I had ear infections that were stopping me from swimming. And by the time my ear infections improved and got better, I'd been racing a bike because I'm competitive and I was like, needed to race. So he said to me, when I was sort of presented with this opportunity to switch sports, he said, well, if you were my daughter, I would tell you to switch, because we know we're going to have a Games in London. We know that you're most likely to be probably too old as a swimmer.
And actually, at that point, you were what age?
26.
Right, yeah.
And it was 5 years later. 7 years later, sorry. And he said, what we know now is that you have this opportunity. I'd already won European championships. I'd broken the world record. I was clearly capable, if not, a complete cyclist. So he said, it's got to be worth the risk. And so he said, if you go to Beijing in sort of 3 years' time, that gives you that sense of setting yourself up. So yeah, it was with a heavy heart, but also with sort of this excitedness that I decided that, yeah, I would switch sports. And from the beginning of 2006, that was me officially a cyclist.
Is there much of a difference, I suppose, in your colleagues in the swimming world and the cycling world? I obviously think about You know, rowers at university were a certain type. I mean, is there a different level of camaraderie, or is it pretty similar?
It's very different. I think cyclists are generally older. You know, the swim team is a very young team. Most of the people I'd been swimming with were in their teenage years, early 20s, mid 20s. There were not that many swimmers over the age of 30. Whereas in cycling, I was the youngest. The team I went into, I was the youngest again. And I was like, wow, this is so strange. I'm 27 and I'm the youngest on the team. So for me, it was a very different and much more adult environment. And I think it was Rebecca Romero who said when she switched from rowing into cycling, rowing had been like being at school and cycling was like being at university. And it was very similar for swimming. It was like having been at school, now you're at university. And also because you had to be in control of your own training, there was no appointment with the road ride. You could ride from your front door when you chose to within, you know, any hour of the day. If you wanted to go out in the dark, that was fine. So it was very much a case of managing your time, and that really suited me at that point in my life.
Now, you make it to Beijing.
I do.
And you win gold. So you're ahead of schedule in your plan, right?
Absolutely. And that was the thing. We very quickly realized that I was very capable over that individual pursuit, 3,000 meters. I was knocking on the door of riding on the Olympic team, but we had Rebecca Romero, Wendy Hoevenagel, who were just that little bit better than me. And I was third at national champs all the time. And it was only after the games in Beijing that I managed to kind of elevate myself to the national champion to be the best. And then by that point, that event was taken out of the games. So I never got to kind of push myself towards trying to qualify for the Olympics in my main event on the track. But that was okay because it pushed me to the point of the time I did in Beijing would have placed me seventh at the Olympic Games. And that put me on this path towards competing in Delhi at the Commonwealth Games. So myself and Laura, now she's Laura Kenny, we were the two English riders who competed for England in Delhi in that individual pursuit. And that was part of the whole process towards the team pursuit that won gold in London. And I was a rider five of the squad of four that went. I was kind of the non-travelling reserve, if you like.
Obviously, you were seasoned in your Olympic Games, Commonwealth and more. What was the difference in terms of playing to that home crowd in London or performing?
It was incredible, but you also had to make sure that it didn't overawe you, because you have to be prepared to compete in an empty room. It's the thing I kept saying in the run-up to London. Whether there's one person or 10,000 people, your job is the same. And then ironically, of course, when we got to Tokyo, there was no one in the room. We did do it in an empty stadium.
So actually all that training
all
suddenly.
All that training, yeah, that mindset was really important.
Because lots of athletes said they really struggled with that at Tokyo, didn't they? You know, just in that sense of just...
Yeah, and people talk about whether you feed off the crowd. And I always say it's a dangerous thing to have to rely on, because you don't know how hostile or not the crowd will be, or even if it's going to be there. So focusing on your job, which doesn't change regardless of those external factors, I think was the right thing to do. And that helped manage that noise in the velodrome, because you knew it was going to be there, but you weren't focusing on it. You were focusing on the black line or on the road or whatever it was that you were doing in that particular day of the event.
Now, we talked about you as a champion in the paracycling. How did the two contests compare? And when it comes, I suppose, to things like sponsorship, how does that come about?
Well, it's very different. And I was very involved with trying to, and still am, make sure that women's cycling is elevated to the same level as men's cycling. Because if we're talking about the differences between, you know, Olympic and Paralympic sponsorship opportunities and outside of Olympic and Paralympic games as well, then paracycling will never have the same opportunities if the men and women aren't equal. And I've always used the able-bodied competitions as a training tool, as a way of bettering myself. Obviously, very different trying to manage one brake and all the gears on one side of the bike and the balance issues that comes with. Of course, if you're riding up and down a bike lane on the embankment, there's no difference at all. But when you get to that elite level of sport, having two hands that are holding onto a bike is actually a much bigger contribution than even I first appreciated. So I think it's probably one of the things that most people ask, well, why is she a Paralympian? It's a bike, surely that's just her legs. So for me, it gave me a chance to keep putting myself out of my comfort zone, keep improving technically. If you can survive in that great big bunch of women with the technical setup that I have, then when it comes to the smaller numbers in the paracycling races, you've obviously got a huge advantage. And that's what I do. That's what all of my competitors do, actually. We all race with the women as often as we can, and trying to elevate the opportunities for paracyclists by saying, look, we're very, very similar. There are some technical differences, but really we should be getting the same opportunity. But sadly, even today, like last week at the World Championships, prize money for the women, the men, you know, the under 23s, the juniors and the able-bodied side, no prize money for paracycling. So there's a huge gap that still needs to be filled.
What do you think can be done there, I suppose, as in you look at your career, you would expect that to make the point to a degree.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, does it come down to how many people want to go and see it? Like, where does it start? Because obviously it's not a direct read across, but you know, the Lionesses and female football, often you need a bit of a, there can be a moment which just becomes a bit of a sea change in how people see it, right?
Absolutely right. And I think what we need is there's a circle and we need someone to start to change that and to be the breaking point. And I always think you look at the organisations that are in charge, that have the funding, the finance, that have the backing because of, you know, the biggest events in the world. So the Tour de France, for example, one of the biggest events in the world in any sport. And we're gradually, slowly bringing the female Grand Tours back, but the women still only race for 8 days compared to the men's 3 weeks. So if you have those sorts of events that generate that surplus income that helps you to have a pot of money somewhere that is your reserves, if you like, utilizing that and investing to speculate, to accumulate, to try and make sure that you provide that opportunity to build the platform, to bring the people to watch, to place the sport alongside the sports that are generating more income. So for example, the Integrated World Championships in Zurich, I've been asking for a long time. We don't know when the next one is going to be, but last week was so successful, and having the same courses on the same day as the men and the women, the juniors, the under 23s, gave all paracyclists that platform. It meant the media were there. It meant that everybody, you know, from the broadcast media to the print media, radio, everyone, all the online things as well. So I think by integrating those events, you help to elevate the profile. You help to make sure that athletes have got that narrative in between games, because obviously we see the games on TV, but everyone thinks, you know, well, what have you been doing for 4 years? It's actually World Championships, all of the other events. So by doing that integrated event, I think we'll start to see organisers realising the value, and then also the social impact of the city that you're in or the location, because so many people around the world are living with disabilities of different kinds and they're not being able to access public services. As you know, this country's been a prime example, but the same is true in any country. So utilising it as a platform and as an opportunity for some social impact at the same time.
And did you personally find, as the gold rolled in, it became more financially viable for you as an athlete?
I think as I won more medals, it became an opportunity to tell my story to more people. And being able to go into corporate events and articulate the processes that I've been through, kind of my thought processes, my decision-making processes, sharing that and showing the analogies between sport and business, that provided me with an opportunity. I was so fortunate as well, because after I finished uni, I asked Tani Gray-Thompson, what do you think, how can I make sure I've got another income stream to help pay for this? And she said, well, train as a public speaker. Learn, and that helps with your media training too, but then you can go and do these events like I do, and that's basically been the main source of making sure you can pay for the extra things.
And when we're talking about, I suppose, your career now, well, I mean, we're speaking in Westminster, and obviously we're Current Affairs magazine. You have been doing some work with Andy Burnham as well as a commissioner.
Yeah, so after the Games in London, I was approached by British Cycling, who had one of their policy advisors, Chris Boardman, who wanted to diversify the voices that were talking about the things that needed to be spoken about from a cycle safety perspective for the membership. And they asked if I would start to work with Chris to kind of help promote the importance of road danger reduction. So I got involved initially in 2013, and then in 2019 I was approached by the Mayor of South Yorkshire, who wanted to replicate the opportunity that Greater Manchester was using with Chris Boardman, who was by that point the Walking and Cycling Commissioner for Greater Manchester. So I went to work with Dan Jarvis MP, who's now just, he's an MP, was not a mayor at the same time anymore, and I helped to set up the Active Travel Programme in South Yorkshire, brought in the process for the region to adopt Vision Zero, which is where there'll be zero fatalities or serious injuries on the roads of South Yorkshire by 2040, working with the police and various different partner agencies alongside the mayoral combined authority of Barnsley, Doncaster, Sheffield and Rotherham to try and make sure that that collective group of local authorities work together for the benefits of a mayoral combined authority. So 3 years there, and Dan decided to step down as mayor, which gave me an opportunity to move and work with Andy Burnham because Chris had moved on to be the National Active Travel Commissioner, and the opportunity to work at home. Having a geographical understanding of the region is a huge benefit. I kept saying to people and apologising when they were talking about places in South Yorkshire, I need to visit because I'm not really sure. And actually just having that chance to, when you've lived in a place, you understand the kind of history from everything, from where the buses started and stopped when you were at school to how the train service have evolved or not, as the case may be. So now we have the B network, which is the integrated public transport system, with the vision being that it becomes like London by, you know, 2040. And we have the buses that are almost completely under public control now, the final phase of that franchising process taking place on January the 5th. We have the Metrolink, which has been there for, you know, decades, I think 3 decades now. And we're trying to make sure that the glue that holds that together is the walking and cycling routes.
There's reports today that HS2 might even get to.
HS2 light, I think.
HS2 light. Would you welcome that?
I think we have to look at the challenges that we face with capacity on our railways. And that's by no means part of my expertise, yeah. But I do sit in on a lot of meetings where being able to improve passenger experience also becomes part of it, because you're integrating into that public transport system. And if people are walking and cycling to their local public transport hub to make longer journeys using public transport, then rail is a huge part of that. We also know that safety on our roads is hugely affected by the number of large vehicles. So if we're having to move freight around because we don't have capacity on the railways, then that adds danger to our road networks and means that at some point those large vehicles are going to be in highly densely populated parts of our city.
And then looking ahead to LA and the Olympics there.
I think it's going to be an amazing Olympics, and I also think it's an opportunity for Los Angeles to third time lucky for the Paralympics. In 1984, when they hosted the Summer Olympics, they refused to host the Paralympics. And it was hosted in New York, except for wheelchair athletes that were hosted in Stoke Mandeville. So for in 1984, the Paralympics was literally not in America properly. In 1996, we had the Atlanta Olympic and Paralympic Games. And that was equally challenging, especially for the Paralympians, completely different organising committees. And it was actually a watershed moment for the IOC, because after the experience of the Atlanta Games, they insisted upon the same organising committee doing both games for the future games. So they've, as an American host, have had a huge challenge with hosting the Paralympics properly in the past. So this is the opportunity. And having seen their sort of advert, if you like, at the closing ceremony in Paris, it's very exciting how they're utilising some of their star athletes, as any games would, to help promote what they're planning to do in the Sunshine State.
And just two final questions for me. I just wondered, do you think you have to be quite single-minded to be a successful athlete? Is it one of those disciplines where, you know, you talked about the thing at school, from the, oh, no sleepovers or whatever, you know, but just generally as a, to be that focused and to be at the standard you need to be, does it require that?
You definitely need single-mindedness. But I think one of the things I've found is that since I became a mum, Louisa arrived in 2013 and Charlie in 2017, it gives you that yin and yang, because as a parent, it's the most selfless job in the world, the most selfish role you'll ever have. But as an athlete, you almost have to be the most selfish version of yourself, because you've got to protect your own performance. You've got to know who you can trust. You've got to be able to weedle out the people who aren't being helpful. Or I think I spoke about it before the games in Paris, the sort of toxic people who aren't really there for your benefit. They're just there.
And more like hangers on, or
well, yeah. More just that not every decision that's made on your behalf is always going to be the right one, yeah, for you. And I think knowing how to handle those things and navigate your way around things to give your best performance and what matters, and making sure that the noise that can creep in, especially around games time, when there's so many more eyeballs on the sport, you know, there's so many more people watching, there's so many more press tribunes and more people in the mix zone. So I think it's really important that you have that. And experience gives you that sort of sense of what you need to make a decision over and what's important. But yeah, you do have to be incredibly single-minded and know how to make decisions. And some athletes will talk about the sacrifices they've made. And I always think I don't perceive it as a sacrifice. I perceive it as a choice, because if you've got two you've got a decision. You've got to choose between two things. And you say, oh, I'm sacrificing that so I can do this. At some point, you start to resent the thing that you can't do. So I always think if you're making that choice and you're accepting that you've got to make a choice and you're making a decision for a reason, then you back yourself with that decision, whether that's to miss a friend's hen do, or, and I've done that and sent a doll on my place, which is now a mascot, or whether that's missing an event to do something with your family and say, actually, I'm not going to that race because, and I had to do that in 2018. We were supposed to be racing the world championships on the track in back in Rio, and there was a yellow fever outbreak in Brazil. And in order to go, everyone needed to have the vaccine, but I was breastfeeding Charlie, who was 5 months old. And if I wanted to have the vaccine, I couldn't breastfeed Charlie. So I was like, well, there's a very simple decision there. I'm not going to the World Championships. It was the first qualifying event for Tokyo. I spoke to the team manager. I said, look, this is my child's health and well-being is far more important than a World Championship title. And they were like, that's fine. So I stepped aside and they selected other people to go to qualify, the initial qualifying process. But those are the sorts of decisions I think you have to make sometimes, but you also have to have a sense of person and human nature as well. And I think over a long period, you develop the skills to have both.
I said only one more question, but I have a very quick one, which is just, do you have any superstitions on like a race day? No.
So no, you won't be surprised I don't have any superstitions.
You don't have a crystal at you.
No. Sometimes you want a crystal ball because you're so nervous about what's going to happen. You're like, I wish someone would just tell me how I'm going to feel tomorrow morning. But no, no superstitions, I think. And I don't listen to music or anything like that. I kind of very much have just me and my equipment and I go. And I think as simple as possible.
The final question is one we ask everyone on this podcast, which is just, what is the worst advice you've ever received in your career? Could be at school, but you know, just throughout. Perhaps you did ignore it. Hopefully you ignored it.
I did ignore it. I think it's a very difficult question because I ignored it. And so therefore I can't remember what it was, because you kind of brush it aside and think, that's so bad, I don't want to take it. But maybe the worst advice was the advice I was saying to you about earlier at school, where they advised me not to talk about what I did. And maybe if I'd been allowed to talk about it a little bit, not be the big show off, maybe if there was a happy medium between what they advised and what could have been, maybe just talking about it a little bit would have helped some of those children who were, maybe they were overawed and that's why they bullied me, because I was different. So maybe the advice from school, but they were doing it with their best intentions because they wanted me to have the opportunity to focus on my studies and not be distracted by what could have been. So maybe that's the worst advice. The other one was that when I first started swimming, they said I maybe have started too old to be any good. But it wasn't really advice. It was more just a comment.
A sweeping assumption and judgment. Yeah, we don't like those either. Sarah, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you.